Buon appetito.
Guten Appetit.
Smacznego.
Sahten.
Jeg håber, I vil nyde maden.
请大家尽量吃. Here on earth.
Here on earth.
Enjoy your meal. Here on earth.
Here on earth.
Приємного апетиту.
Here on earth.
The Year of the Dragon begins this Monday, and fireworks, like the ones we're hearing from last year's celebration in Singapore, will blast off in Chinese neighborhoods all over the world. The Chinese invented gunpowder and are justifiably proud of their fireworks displays. They're equally proud of their food, as Nate Tate and his sister, Mary Kate, discovered. Traveling 9,700 miles by train, bicycle, rickshaw, camel, and donkey cart in search of authentic Chinese food in all its mouth-watering diversity. Welcome to Food Friday on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Faraca. This hour, Feeding the Dragon. Have you been to China? How does Chinese food in the West compare to food on the mainland? Are you Chinese? What foods from home do you miss most? Have you ever participated in a Chinese New Year's celebration? What did you eat? To join the conversation, call 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. Email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. To follow us on Facebook or Twitter, just go to Here on Earth Show, and that's one word. Nate Tate was one of the first Texas college students to study at Beijing's prestigious Tsinghua University. He toured 19 of China's 22 provinces and worked as a restaurant designer in Beijing. Together with his sister, he is co-author of Feeding the Dragon, a culinary travelogue through China with recipes. Hi, Nate.
Hi.
And so, with you, of course, is your sister, Mary Kate.
Hi, good to be here.
Hi, Mary Kate. Let me introduce you properly. Mary Kate Tate studied at Nanjing University and worked as a teacher and writer in China. And she, together with her brother, Nate, is also co-author of Feeding the Dragon. And the two of you are, I think, the most adventuresome sister and brother duo I have ever come across. I mean, hats off. Kudos. What an incredible deal.
It was fun. It was really fun.
It was also tiring. All those miles really make you tired.
And also dangerous. I mean, I started off by reading an account of your adventure in the jungle. My Lord.
Yeah, it's funny. Now that the book's out, our parents have read these stories, and they're like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe our kids were doing this over there.
First time out of the country, first time away on your own. And what do? Oh, let's go to the jungle.
With no supplies and, yeah, get lost.
With a map that gets rained on the minute you get off the bus. And, you know, nothing but a tarp. I mean, tell us a little bit about this adventure, but then I gotta find out how you celebrated New Year.
Sure. I was over there in 2001 as an exchange student, and Mary Kate came over to visit me, and we decided to go do something crazy and go trekking in the jungles of southern China.
I was 16. It was the summer before my senior year of high school, and I had never been to Asia. I didn't know anything about it, so I was just amazed as soon as I got off the plane at how different it was. And so, you know, Nate and I were like, what can we do that's exciting and the most fun? And we thought, let's get on, you know, a bus. I first started on a train and then a bus to go to the southernmost region of China, which is Shishuangbanna in Yunnan province.
Near Burma.
Exactly.
Right.
And I'm assuming that the jungles that you were exploring were actually analogous to the Burmese jungle.
Yeah, definitely. There's the culture is very similar on either side of the border.
Yeah.
But yeah, we ended up getting all we had was a tarp. It was the rainy season. The map was destroyed, and we ended up not being able to stay in a village like we thought we were going to be able to. And when it went up and trekked up into the mountains and covered ourselves up with the tarp, tried to burn a T-shirt to keep away the mosquitoes that I had read had malaria. And we heard some wild screeches in the middle of the night in the pitch blackness, and we decided it'd be better to walk in the valley than stay up here with the animals. So we threw off the tarp, went down in the valley, and it took us a couple of days to actually find a place to stay. So that was – we found a village and a family that took us in, and they made some amazing food for us.
Let us stay the night under a mosquito tarp.
Yeah. Got us hooked.
So do you remember what you ate?
We had – it was funny. We were going to sleep, and I remember sleeping on the wood slats of the hut. And underneath the hut is where they keep all the livestock and the animals. And I remember hearing a pig squeal.
The house is built on stilts.
Uh-huh. Because of the monsoon.
Right.
And then we woke up in the morning and we had fresh sausage. So I assume that squeal was probably... yeah. But it was really good sausage.
It was a short wicker table in the middle of the room. And, they covered the table with banana leaves. Laid out, there was fresh mango slices for us, peanuts. It's a common thing there.
That's just amazing. These are perfect strangers.
They
found you guys wandering, not knowing what the heck you were doing, and they take you in and feed you and spread banana leaves on the table.
Yeah.
When we finally made it back to a city, civilization after this. We, came into town and there was just a huge celebration, fireworks, and just everyone was just celebrating in the streets. And we wondered, what is it? Are they celebrating our return? and we looked on the TV, and that was the night when it was announced that Beijing had won the 2008 Olympics.
Oh, that was a tremendous celebration.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So you were there for the Olympics? No.
That was in 2001 when it was announced, so they were excited that they were going to be able to host it in 2008.
And they spent the next 7 years just building up Beijing, especially with, modern amenities and buildings. And but we were gone. We were not there in 2008, no. Mm. I wish we were.
So
to see the change from before and then after the Olympics, it's a different city entirely.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. But that initial experience you had, as naive as you were and as lucky as you were, I mean, you could have stepped on, a python in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But that sort of set the tone for your whole adventure.
It did. I think, there was a bit of adrenaline, when we didn't know where we were going to stay and we didn't have water. And I think
it turned us into adrenaline junkies.
It kind of did.
And the whole idea of being taken care of by strangers, throwing yourself on the mercy of strangers, that seems to have been one of the themes.
It's very easy to travel around China now and stay in very nice hotels. They've made, the major cities have nice hotels and you can go on tours. But I think to get to know the country, it's nice to go off the beaten track. And we really threw ourselves into that idea.
And people were so kind.
They were. I think Chinese people are very nice, very kind. And I think also the fact that we speak Chinese and we've made the effort to learn Chinese.
As foreigners, they think of us as guests in their country, and they want to show us, their food and their culture. And so, as people who have come over there as foreigners and interested in their language and getting to know them, we felt very welcome, and people were receptive to, we'd ask, what's your favorite dish from this region? And we'd be actually invited to back to their home to cook with them. So that was very common all throughout the country.
Uh-huh. And so your dad was right, in a way. I mean, if it hadn't been for him, Nate, you probably wouldn't have decided to study Chinese, and you wouldn't have gone to China as a business student.
That's true. Yeah, my dad said when I went to college as a freshman, I had to take a language requirement. And he said, oh, you know, study Chinese. China's the future of business, because that was my major at the time was business. And I took a couple semesters, and I loved it. And I ended up – I found out they had this exchange program. My university had an exchange program with a university in China that no one had taken advantage of. They were sending students to the States, but no one was coming from our school. So I decided to take advantage of it, and it was the best decision I made.
And so I would have loved to have been in on that phone call when you talked your sister into coming with you.
Yeah, she wasn't that hard to convince.
I'm curious about your relationship as you were as younger kids. I mean, Nate, were you always were the two of you often together? Did you have adventures as young children?
Yeah, our dad was in the Air Force, so we moved around a lot growing up, and there'd be times when we'd go to a new place and we didn't know anyone but each other. So
we were the new kids in town, and so we were kind of our only friends.
Mm. Yeah, especially if we'd get there at the beginning of the summer. We'd have the whole summer just to...
And Nate's someone who, he always comes up with kind of cockamamie ideas, and a lot of times, you know, dishes he'll want to make up, concoctions. And so he'd always convince me to get in on it. So we were always, we had a little cooking show that we did as kids.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
We filmed it on a video camera. The dogs were the people in the audience.
We'd have people come watch.
Yeah.
So it started at a young age. And I think, you know, we saw going over to China together, it was a new frontier. And it was just, you know, it's been just a passion of ours for 10 years.
So what sorts of things did you cook in your cooking show?
I just watched one recently when I went home to visit my parents, and we made Betty Crocker box brownies. So,
we started pretty simple back then.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So, Mary Kate, you must have a lot of trust in your big brother.
Well, the time when we went down to the jungle, that was a good example of when I probably shouldn't have trusted him.
Yeah, right. You know,
I thought, you know, maybe we should go get, you know, backpacks and, you know, supplies and things. And he said, oh, you know, I'm an Eagle Scout and I'll take care of us. We don't really need to buy all that stuff. And we really should have. So he listens to me more now.
Yeah.
So was there any moment in that, you know, in the middle of that trip when you got mad at each other?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that summer, and then also we came back in 2005 to write the book. And traveling around, and as you can imagine, with a brother and sister team, you know, the good thing is that you know the person very well, and you can kind of say what's on your mind. But also, you're not trying to be polite, and so there can be arguments for sure.
When we started out, you know, we had this idea that we wanted to travel, you know, this you know 9,700 mile route, and you know it was places we'd already been and things. We kind of knew the recipes we wanted to get, but we really had to figure out as we went how to approach restaurants, how to approach people. You know, hi, you know, talk to the waitress and say, hi, we really love this Kung Pao chicken. Can we come back and meet the chef and have him show us how to cook it and let us take pictures and write things down? So that was, you know, trying to figure out who had to be the one to ask.
And talk about cockamamie ideas. Sometimes I can kind of think that things are going to take a shorter amount of time than they do. I really thought that in 2005 we'd go over for that summer, we'd travel around for 3 months and collect these stories, recipes, photos, and then at the end of the summer we'd have the book done and it'd be out in time for Christmas.
And I believed that originally, and it ended up taking 6 years.
We had to get a book deal, and yeah, it was a lot more work.
And move back to China for a couple of years.
But you know, it's really a wonderful book. This is really a wonderful book. I don't know anything about cooking Chinese, but I'm going to take it home and try some of these recipes.
Great.
And the photographs are great, and it's laid out wonderfully, and it's really like a, well, it's a cook's tour, isn't it?
Yes.
Right.
We're talking this hour with Mary Kate Tate and Nate Tate. Brother and sister team. They traveled all over China together. They both can speak Mandarin. And they collected these authentic recipes from all these different areas of China, discovering that Chinese food is a lot more complicated and interesting than just Cantonese and Sichuan. We're going to find out more about it right after this break. We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. Email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. You can also reach us on Facebook or Twitter by going to Here on Earth Show. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Food Friday on Here on Earth. Mary Kate Tate and Nate Kate are together the co-authors of this brand new, really exciting cookbook, Feeding the Dragon, a culinary travelogue through China with recipes. What they wanted to do was highlight the various culinary traditions of China. Chinese food we normally see in the West is from the South and often from Hong Kong. But there's also amazing and different food in Tibet, Xinjiang, Portuguese fusion foods in Macau, and so on and so forth. We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07. What do you know about the extraordinary, rich and diverse culinary traditions, I should say, of China? And have you ever celebrated Chinese New Year? What kind of foods did you eat? 1-877-GLOBE-07 is the number to call. That's 1-877-456-2307. We have an email from Katie, who writes, I just loved the yogurt in Beijing, the small alleys near the Forbidden City sections of the city. I think she's speaking about the Hutong. Had vendors selling various items. There were crates full of brown mug-type vessels with paper tops. My friend and I stopped to ask, but as neither of us spoke Chinese, the gentleman thought we wanted to buy them. He stuck a straw in each and typed the amount due in a calculator. We shrugged our shoulders, paid him the 8 yuan, about 75 cents, yuan, 75 cents each, and walked away, sucking at the mystery inside. So rich, smooth, and just a hint of sweetness. Yogurt, Beijing yogurt. You guys must be familiar with that.
Yes, I know those little yogurt jars very well.
Before I left, I actually went and bought, you know, 8 different ones so I could have a set at home.
Of
the mugs.
Drink cups.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's neat. What else? I mean, one of the very first recipes in the book is of Peking duck. And I found that very intriguing because I had heard in the past the intricate process by which Peking duck is prepared with a bicycle pump that you blow the duck
yeah.
up with and create that space between the skin and the body so that the skin becomes really crispy. And then it has to be hung in a western wind for I forget how long. And you guys found a shortcut.
We did. The most important thing to make the duck is to have the skin really dry so when it cooks, it roasts, it's crispy. And we decided you can hang it in a cool, windy place like a you know a refrigerator, put a fan on it, or you can also use a hairdryer and blow dry the bird.
I love that. That is so American.
Yeah.
You don't have to hang the duck in a western wind.
Yeah. You know, there is something to say for actual duck. The ducks in Beijing, where they pump them full of air, they let them dry over for a long period of time, and then they smoke them or roast them over fruit tree coals, and it's a very elaborate process for sure. Something that would be very difficult to create at home, but this is kind of a close tasting equivalent, and I think it's tastes very similar.
And there's a special kind of sort of a honey glaze that you have to paint on the duck?
Yeah, you brush honey and Shaoxing rice wine, a mixture of that, and just put a couple coats of that and let that dry. And that kind of gives the duck that, when it roasts, it gives it that brown, orangey color that so, you know, the duck, Beijing duck or Peking duck is known for.
Uh-huh. And then you don't eat the duck whole. It's a kind of fajita sort of presentation.
Yeah. I'm surprised that it's actually not caught on more as a food here. I think it's something that Americans would like a lot. But you cut it up into little slivers. You can keep the skin separate from the meat. And then you just put it in a mandarin pancake, like a mushu wrap, a little smear of brown sauce, sweet noodle paste, and some cucumbers and green scallions. Roll it up, and there you go.
Ah, you got me. My mouth is watering. And is that one of the New Year's foods?
You could eat it. It is kind of a celebratory meal, so you could definitely eat that. But if you're going to – there are some foods that you definitely do want to eat for Chinese New Year. And one of those would be jiaozi dumplings.
Mm-hmm.
They're the boiled dumplings with pork and cabbage inside. And it's kind of a thing. We were over in Beijing for Chinese New Year 2 years ago and went to a family's house, one of Mary-Kate's co-worker's house. And they set up this big assembly line with the whole family. And, you know, one person is the, one person stuffs the dumplings, one person crimps them and folds them, and one person boils them. And we were a part of that.
Mm. That's fun.
It is. It's fun. I like to do it. I invite people over and put them to work making dinner.
One of the things that's a tradition in China for Chinese New Year, which we did that night, is in one of the dumplings you put a coin, and the person who eats that dumpling with the coin, you're going to have luck in the new year. So we did that, and I remember, you know, we were eating them, and I kind of wanted to eat the one that had the coin in it, but I also didn't want to, you know, chip a tooth or anything.
Yeah. But yeah, the reason you eat jiaozi dumplings, Chinese dumplings, for New Year is because the word jiaozi was actually the word for the initial currency in China many, many years ago.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
It actually is shaped like what it used to look like, the gold coins.
The crescent shape. So yeah, if you eat those, supposedly you'll have a good fortune and, you know, get to make some money in the New Year.
There are lots of, I guess we have to call them superstitions, that are associated with New Year's. I mean, not just in China, but everywhere. You know, the whole idea of fireworks, I've heard that replicated in various other traditions. You know, the idea is that noise keeps the bad spirits away.
Yeah. In Beijing, you kind of just have to see it to believe it, the amount of fireworks. I'd heard it described many times, but actually being there, it's unbelievable. If you stand up on top of the building and look over the city, it looks like the city is under siege, because there are so many fireworks. Mm. We were that family's house that we went to 2 years ago. We went out at midnight into the middle of the apartment complex, and we had some fireworks. And there were so many people setting off industrial grade fireworks that they were like bouncing off the sides of buildings and.
And this went on for hours. And even at one point, you know, basically a rocket shot up and caught one of the buildings on fire.
Oh, my goodness.
And no one stopped. They just, you know, no one stopped shooting off fireworks. So this apartment complex was burning. And it took 45 minutes for the fire department to come, I'm sure because they were busy, you know, going after other fires in the city.
Yeah.
Wow. We have Nan joining us from Madison. Hi, Nan.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the phone. I am from China. I am from the Yunnan province. I have visited the jungle that your guests were describing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm glad you get a chance to enjoy the jungle. I love it very much. So I have two questions. Have you guys been able to try some of those exotic food in the jungle, like the bee larva and also the bamboo grub or worm when you were there?
We definitely had the bee larva. We had that in I think in Kunming, they have the capital of Yunnan province, they have an alcohol that's famous for bee larvae. There's lots of bee larvae in it, right?
But you stopped short at the bamboo grub.
Yeah, I think I saw that but didn't try that one.
Yeah, my dad tried it. I didn't try the bamboo grub, but the bee larvae is like my favorite. So my dad told me the bamboo grub is really tasty. So next time you should try it.
Yeah.
So now
we love Yunnan. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, and I, you know, you guys are making me really homesick because, you know, one of the things I miss a lot is the real Chinese food. You know, I just feel so sad that a lot of things are Americanized, but not in a, like a creative or like innovative way. Instead, it loses the original, like the features that really attract
That's true.
People or foodies like us.
You know, I think that unfortunately that is the pattern that most new immigrant foods take. At first, they're much truer to source, and then slowly but surely they become Americanized. They adapt to the American palate, which is far less tolerant of spice, for one thing. Just more bland, I think. So that's unfortunate, but I sympathize with you, Nan. Tell us about some
Thank
of the other foods
me.
That you miss most.
Oh, so the Cantonese food, even though I am not from Guangdong, you know, I developed a liking for Cantonese food, and they have very wonderful pastries. They sort of, I think, absorbed some of the French elements because they have those puffs. I don't know whether your guests had a chance to try those, but the filling, for instance, in the puff, it's kind of like a croissant kind of thing. But the filling, they adapted it. So they put, for instance, the barbecued pork or the curried beef. And Jean, if you are interested, I know like Minneapolis definitely have that.
Really?
I just came back. Uh-huh. Yeah, I just came back from Minneapolis from a visit there. And every time I go there, I make sure I stop at the Cantonese bakery and get a whole stash, a huge box of that pastry. So that's something I really like. They are not super sweet, you know. If they have sugar in the filling, they wouldn't have sugar in the skin. So it's really, complex flavor and texture. So I love that, too.
That sounds so interesting. Thank you so much for calling, Nan. We are at 1-877-GLOBE-07. Nan is Chinese, as you have just been hearing, and she's missing the food from her own part of China. 877-456-2307. We're talking about authentic Chinese recipes. Nate and his sister, Mary Kate, a very adventuresome brother and sister duo who traveled all over China and collected authentic recipes from each of the different provinces and came back to put them together with a lot of photographs in a wonderful, big, very inviting cookbook. We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07. Email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. You can also send a Facebook or a Twitter message by going to Here on Earth Show. And we have Carl joining us next, also from Madison. Hi, Carl.
Howdy, Gina and guests. I have to make a comment about the subject you were just talking about I can't think of the word malleable. I don't want to use the word plastic because it has negative connotations, but I've had Chinese food in Port-au-Basque, Newfoundland, in Mexico, in the Netherlands, in Morocco, in Spain, and I'm sure other places. And, I think it's a tribute to the food that it takes on those local characteristics, and each one is unique.
You know, you remind me, Carl, that we once did a program about the phenomenon of Chinese restaurants all around the world, because the Chinese, like the Jews, are everywhere, and everywhere they went, they opened restaurants. And you're absolutely right. Each culinary tradition adapts to the local cuisine. And becomes...
That is true.
Go ahead, Nate.
Oh, I was going to say, in our book, we have a chapter on Macau, which is... It was a former Portuguese colony. And I think it's a very interesting type of food where it's Portuguese and Chinese fused food.
Yeah,
I like the fusion food.
Give us an example of something from Macau.
Well, there's Macanese fried rice, which it's like regular Chinese fried rice, but it has black olives, chorizo, sausage,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes it'll have bacalao, pork or cod in it, salted cod.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
That's very Portuguese, bacalao.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Salt cod. It's a staple.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And
thank you, Carl. I just want to say goodbye to Carl, and thank you so much for the call. We have Samantha joining us next from Nina. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, ma'am. I was just curious if they had a chance to try eggs and tomato. I tried that while I was in China teaching, and it was one of my favorite things. I ate it, like, every day.
Where were you teaching, Samantha?
I was in Boxing, which is in Shandong province, which, I don't know, like an hour or so away from Beijing.
In what direction?
I believe it was north. I wasn't really that great with my directions or my Chinese while I was there, so I kind of just went with the flow. But
so what was so special about eggs and tomatoes?
I don't know. It was just really good. It was like scrambled eggs with chunks of tomato put in there, and I think they just put it in with some kind of oil. And then I know I had asked many people, you know, how do you make this? So when I go home, I can make it. And they said they put like a little bit of sugar and a little bit of salt and then like those long green onions. And it was just the flavor of the tomato, covering the eggs just tasted delicious. Everybody looks at me like I'm crazy when I ask her. Now that I'm home, they're like, why would you mix eggs and tomato together? But I thought they tasted delicious.
Did you have it for breakfast, Samantha? Or
I would eat it 3 times a day if I could. Like, if we were out at the market, I would order it with whatever else. But it seems like they would get a couple of things to eat and then put them on a table and just kind of everybody shared it. But that was one thing that you could get as your own. I would put on rice a lot, too.
Uh-huh.
That was my favorite thing. I can't find any Chinese place around here that will make it for me either. They all look at me like I'm crazy, too. So I'm like, I know I ate it in China, and nobody else knows what it is. But.
Okay, so Nate and Mary-Kate, are you familiar with this special eggs and tomato dish that Samantha went so crazy over?
We know exactly what she's talking about. We love it, too, and it's such a simple thing. And you think, you know, tomatoes and egg doesn't sound very good, but it's delicious. And it's actually in our book.
So how do you make it?
It's very simple. We disagreed on whether we should put it in the book because it's so simple. We thought people might think, oh, it's in a cookbook. But yeah, you boil the tomatoes so the skins come off, and then you cut them up. You mix them with the eggs, a little bit of ginger and green onion, and then add some sugar to it. And that's basically about it.
I'm surprised.
The sugar kind of acts like MSG.
I see. I'm surprised at how many recipes have a little bit of sugar.
Yeah. Like I said, in China, they do put MSG in a lot of dishes. And one way that you can kind of get around that is by adding sugar to it. It kind of adds that same sweet, savory, umami flavor that MSG gives a dish.
Okay.
And I think tomatoes also have a lot of that flavor already in them. So it's just... It's amazing. You should try it.
Okay, Samantha, I hope you got that. And thanks for your call. This hour is just flying by. We're talking with Mary-Kate Tate and Nate Tate about their tremendous new cookbook, Feeding the Dragon, a culinary travelogue through China with recipes. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Food Friday on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders from Wisconsin Public Radio. To join us on the air, call 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. To send us an email, the address is hereonearth@wpr.org. And for Facebook or Twitter, just go to Here on Earth Show. The Chinese Year of the Dragon begins on Monday, and we're getting ready for it this hour by sharing recipes from Feeding the Dragon, a culinary travelogue through China with recipes with Mary Kate Tate and her brother, Nate Kate. All of these recipes are authentic and tested in the old-fashioned way, you might say. Isn't that right? I mean, didn't you actually go into homes and restaurant kitchens and cook with people right there on the spot and then sharing the food? Wasn't it true that older people in the neighborhood might join in as you were taking photographs and so forth?
They did, yes. We went. The concept of the book is we traveled around and we would find the food that we liked the best, and we'd go back into people's homes or kitchens and restaurants and write down everything they were doing. Then we came back home and cooked everything and tried to duplicate it or replicate it. And yes, when we were taking the photos for the book, the actual like the food photos of the dishes, I lived in a small apartment complex in Beijing. And it was full of older Chinese people. And I would bring the food out because the sunlight is the best light to take these photos in. So I'd bring the food out, set it on the sidewalk, and then take the photos. And they would crowd around and would tell me, you know, they wanted to know what I was doing. They thought it was the strangest thing in the world, which it did look like. It was pretty crazy.
So before we get we've got a lot of calls waiting. Tell us just very quickly about the distinctive styles in each of the provinces. After Beijing, where did you head next?
After Beijing, we went to Shanghai, which is just south of Beijing. And looking at the book, and I'm pulling up the itinerary here. They have it's more sweet foods. They have good noodles and soy sauce chicken. Then we went to Fujian province, which is right below that, and it runs the length of the coast of China. It has like very simple stir fries and a lot of just simple food that's very good. Then we went to Hong Kong, which is kind of the food that you taste in the States because a lot of the immigrants have come from Hong Kong and that area.
Mm-hmm.
There's dim sum. And it's like small dishes that are little snacks.
Uh-huh.
Then Macau, which used to be a Portuguese colony, and it's Portuguese Chinese fusion food. If you can imagine that, like earlier we said, the fried rice with olives and chorizo sausage in it. Then Yunnan province, which is in the south next to Burma, and they have kind of fruit infused dishes and.
And that's where the bee larvae and the bamboo grubs come from.
Yes, yes. And there's the Dai minority. It's a group of people there, the Dai minority, and they have their own set of dishes that are really great. Their culture is similar to the Thai culture, and so they have a lot of Thai sauces, like fish sauce, and they use some mint in the dishes. Then we went to Tibet, which when you think of Tibet, you don't really think of it as a culinary capital. You know, it's so far high, it's so high that the only thing that grows there is barley, and they have yaks that live. So, but we were surprised, you know, that Tibet borders India and Nepal, and the flavors have kind of come across the border, and there's some really unique things that are happening there.
Mm.
Then Sichuan province, it's very spicy. And then last, Xinjiang province, which it's one of the largest areas in China.
That's the desert.
Yeah, and the Uyghur minority live there. They don't look Asian. They speak a Turkic language that looks like Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And that province borders Afghanistan and Pakistan. So it's like there's flatbreads and lamb kebabs, and it's amazing. It's very good.
So in just that short time that you just took us on that little itinerary, what comes through to me is that food is no respecter of borders.
Yeah, it's very true.
Right.
That all of these things sort of fuse and blend and merge they have intercourse. You could put it that way. We have Jim joining us from Colfax. Hi, Jim.
Oh, this is such a great program. I'm excited to listen to every word. My mother had went to China many years ago, back in the 80s, for an outreach program through the community. She came back and discussed how great the food was. But ever since then, I've wondered. She has since gone, but I've wondered. She talked about a 1,000-year-old egg, or something about an egg that had a distinct smell that was buried. And I'm just wondering if there's more to it. If you could give me some answers on just an old egg, or it's almost like a rotten egg, I guess it was discussed as.
I think it's duck egg, isn't it?
There's different types.
Uh huh. Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, they're predominantly, you normally see the duck eggs, but there are chicken eggs and quail eggs that they do the same process to. And they're soaked in a type of vinegar, I believe, for a long time, and it gives them that color and that smell. And there are very few dishes that I don't like in Chinese food, but that is one of them. It's just kind of the gelatinous texture that the egg turns into, and then the smell is a little off-putting, but... I know what you're talking about.
So it's not really 1,000 years old.
No, it smells like it, but no.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Jeff next in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, hi. I love this show. I too have eaten Chinese all around. A couple of years ago, I was in Ghana doing a workshop training, and I was eating sort of institutional food and getting tired of it. And I walked across the street. This was on the coast, and there was this big old bowling alley. And I said, what the heck? And it had a Chinese sign over. So I went in, and it turned out this guy, he was from Fujian province, had been into bowling in China, belonged to a bowling club, heard through that there was a bowling alley in Ghana for sale. So he moved to Ghana and bought the bowling alley, and he set up a huge Chinese restaurant right on attached to it. And I went in, and this place could have seated, I don't know, hundreds, 1,000 people. I was the only one there in this huge hall, and he was this lonely guy sitting by the door as people came. So on the way out, I sat down, I talked to him for a while. I said, well, how long are you going to be here? He says, oh, I'll be here 20 years or so, and then I'll probably go home. And I just looked at him. He was all by himself, just bought a bowling alley, but what he'd done... He had brought, I guess Fujian cuisine, I think there's a lot of seafood, it's spicy. And
yeah,
it appealed very much, although there weren't a lot of Ghanaians in the restaurant the night I was there. He had taken what amounts to Fujian cuisine and made it Ghanaian, and I had some of the best Chinese food I've had on the coast of Ghana in a lonely bowling alley. Anyway,
that's
I'll
great.
Listen off there.
That's a great story. Oh, thank you, Jeff. Let's go to Alex next in Racine. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Oh, I love this program. This is so great. In 2008, I studied Chinese in Guangxi province in Guilin, and I just miss so much food. I miss the baozi, the steamed dumplings, but the one I miss most is hot pot huoguo. And I'm just wondering if your book, which I'm definitely going to buy, I'm very excited about, has anything about hot pot
Absolutely.
And how everybody gets together about that.
Absolutely. Nate, you want to tell us about hot pot?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. We both crave hot pot. We were just saying yesterday in New York, we can't even really find a good restaurant that has it. But we do have two recipes in our book. We have the Mongolian style and then the Sichuan style, which is so spicy. But yeah, I know what you're saying. It's definitely one of my favorite Chinese dishes.
Well, tell us how it's made and what is it that makes it so special?
Well, I'll talk about the Sichuan style. It looks basically like a giant bubbling cauldron of red spicy broth in the middle of a table. And it's kind of like Chinese fondue. There's this broth in the middle of the table and then small sliced, thinly sliced ingredients. And everyone just takes the ingredients they want, dunks them in the broth, lets them cook a couple seconds. And because they're thin, the meat will cook very quickly or the vegetables. You take it out and you can put it in like a sesame paste sauce and then you eat it. And it's kind of an interactive meal to eat.
Because everybody stands around the hot pot?
Yeah, it's in the middle of your table and you're sitting down.
And it also has that Sichuan flavor, which is mala, which is mouth-numbing spicy. It's a combination of Sichuan peppercorns and chili peppers, dried red chili peppers. And so together it creates that mouth-numbing spicy, which is just addicting. And you just keep eating and eating even though your mouth's on fire.
At the end of the meal, you can't even fill your lips because of the Sichuan peppercorn has a chemical in it that makes your mouth literally numb. So it sounds like an torture or something, but it's great.
Alex, does this bring back memories?
Oh, it sure does. And I actually just got the burner for the table, and I got a hot pot for my birthday. So I'm just so excited
to cool.
fire up that recipe.
Okay. Great.
Have fun with it. And what a great recipe to try in zero weather with a snowstorm.
Yeah, true.
Right.
Peter joins us next from Milwaukee. Hi, Peter.
Hi. My question, it's regarding white rice versus brown rice. Now, for years, I started to wonder across America why white rice is used in our land. And even in the tour, and I was in Japan for a bunch of years ago, and it was just, I only had white rice there as well. But then I'm wondering, is there brown rice actually used in some of the China region? And if so, why? And if it's used brown rice in someplace in China area, why not across in the United States? That's my basic question.
Thanks, Peter.
We have actually... I've never seen brown rice served in a Chinese restaurant in China. It's normally the white rice and it's the short grain rice that kind of clumps.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the reason. You know, sometimes you get white rice here in a restaurant and it's the long grain and it kind of falls through your chopsticks as you pick it up and you're like, how can people eat rice with chopsticks? But the rice they use in China it's a clumpy rice, and I don't think that brown rice has that quality. But I've never seen it in China, really. It's they normally go with white rice.
And isn't it in the north where noodles are favored, wheat noodles over rice?
Yeah, in the north, in Beijing, Xinjiang area, they eat more. The starch in their diet is noodles.
Did you learn how to make those noodles the way it's like an accordion player almost, stretching them over and over and over again?
Yeah, we actually had a day where one of the days we had gone up to a Xinjiang restaurant and talked with the chef, and he said, come back tomorrow. And we thought, we'll come back in the morning and have a short lesson on these noodles. And so we got there in the morning, and he handed us, chef whites to the outfits to dress and change into. And then so we changed, and then he put us to work. So we were there till 7 or 8 at night cooking all day. And he put us to work on those la mian, the literally means play the noodles.
Long noodles.
Oh,
right?
Lovely.
You stretch them out between your fingers, and, we were lost. It took a long time to even get close to figuring it out.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. It's been an absolutely delightful hour. And as you can tell, our listeners have very much enjoyed it. It was great having you with us.
It was great being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find links to Mary Kate and Nate Tate's blog, Feeding the Dragon, with recipes for everything from strawberry chili cocktails to kimchi omelets and fried Sichuan green beans when you visit our website at hereonearth.org. Lori Skelton will be sitting in for me next Food Friday, and in preparation, she's been cooking all week from the French slow cooker. Lori is here with us in the studio with a special message.
Hi, Jean. And I've had a chance to start working through Michel Ciccolone's The French Slow Cooker, which is comfort food with a French twist. If you've ever thought that French cooking was too difficult for you to do, doing it in the crock pot seems to help. And what Michel was kind enough to do is let us post some of the recipes from the book on our website, on our Facebook page, ahead of the program. So Michel and I invite you to take this next week and try one or two or all of the recipes we've got up there. We've posted 7. Spinach and egg bouillabaisse, chicken with 40 cloves of garlic, a bargeman's beef stew, a saffron vegetable stew, and then desserts, lemon custard, cherry clafoutis, and a chocolate bread pudding. So the recipes are at hereonearth.org. The recipes are at the Here on Earth Show Facebook page. You've got a week, everybody. I want to hear from you next week as to how you enjoy French slow cookery food.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Lori.
You
and
bet.
I think we'll be up for the challenge. Thanks to Joe Hartke, our technical producer, as always. Laura Zimmerman is our webmaster. Nayantara Mukherjee took your calls and produced today's show with the cooperation of the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Online at international.wisc.edu. And remember, you can always stream and download our shows after they air at hereonearth.org. I'm Jean Faraca. It's a great weekend to stay in and cook. Have a good time, and thanks for listening.